Welcome to Dolly Reads for You with Dolly Howard, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio. And you are live.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is Wednesday, March 27, 2019. You're listening to Dolly Reads for You. I always get my shows mixed up. I do so many, I get mixed up what I'm doing when. So you're listening to Durf Eaton right now. Dolly Reads for You. And we are reading, well, I'm reading it, you're listening, if you are, Real Encounters, Different Dimensions, and Otherworldly Beings. Authors, Brad Steiger and Sherry Hansen Steiger. We got to the chapter, The Master Race from the Inner Earth, last week. And we are at a section, excuse me, called Hypothesis of an Uncharted World in the Hollow Earth. My pillow's hitting my head wrong, so it's hitting the headset. Hold on, I gotta get adjusted here. Oh, that's better. Okay. Hypothesis of an Uncharted World in the Hollow Earth. In 1823, Captain John Cleve Symes, a dour, humorless, retired war hero, petitioned the U.S. Congress for funds to conduct an expedition to explore the Hollow Earth. Captain Symes and his small band of followers felt somewhat anointed for the task because the great American clergyman, Cotton Mather, had defended the theory of a hollow earth in his book, The Christian Philosopher. Mather, in turn, had developed his hypothesis from a little-known essay penned by English astronomer Edmund Halley in 1692. Boy, this isn't set up right either. I'm all out of sorts right now. Hold on. There, let's try this. The theory that there was a vast uncharted world inside our own captured the imagination of Edgar Allan Poe, who in 1835 published his longest tale, The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym, which told of a fantastic land located in the center of our planet, entered by a hole at the South Pole. So convincingly did Poe weave the pseudo-scientific beginning of his narrative that the great educator Horace Greeley soberly endorsed the Pym adventure, or Pym, P-Y-M, adventure as a true account. I never heard of that book. I'm thinking maybe I should check into it. It sounds interesting, if they still have it at 1835. Wow. He obviously did not complete the story and read its later section, which is very evident fantasy. It is likely, however, that young Jules Verne, who would have been 9 years old at that time, did finish reading the story, and many years later may have been inspired to base one of his classic novels, Journey to the Center of the Earth, on a similar theme. That's what it brought to my mind. I love that story. I have watched that movie, and I don't like the new remake that had Pat Boone in it. I didn't like that one. I like the original movie they made. That was the better one. And I watch it over and over and over. I don't know why I like it, I do. Dr. Raymond Bernards, and in parentheses, born Walter Sigmeister, 1901 to 1965. So Dr. Raymond Bernards' The Hollow Earth, 1964, originally published by Fieldcrest Publishing Company of New York, has become the classic work in the rather amorphous field of proving the existence of an inner earth. In his introduction to the book, Dr. Bernard promises to prove that the earth is hollow and not a solid sphere, and that its hollow interior communicates with the surface by two polar openings. I would think there'd be more. Well, in my mind, there's more. My reality is what I make it, so that's the way it is in my world. Dr. Bernard's magnum opus discloses that Rear Admiral Richard E. Byrd flew beyond rather than over the North Pole, and that his later expedition to the South Pole passed 2,300 miles beyond it. According to Dr. Bernard, the North and South Poles have never been reached because they do not exist. In his view, the nation whose explorers first find the entrance to the hollow interior of the earth will become the greatest nation in the world. There is no doubt the leader learns that the mysterious flying saucers come from an advanced civilization in the hollow interior of the earth that, in the event of nuclear war, would provide an ideal refuge for the evacuation of survivors of the catastrophe. I think all that's been done. But we won't tell him. We'll just keep it a secret. Okay. New section called Nazi Nearly Destroyed the World in Seeking the Master Race. Nazis. After Germany's defeat in World War I, a 30-year-old army veteran named Adolf Hitler wandered the streets in 1919 Munich in a state of depression and disillusion. Before the war, he had tried to fulfill his dream of being an artist, and he had lived the bohemian life in Vienna, barely surviving by selling an occasional watercolor and by receiving meager support from his mother. The Academy of Fine Arts had rejected him twice, and after his mother died in 1907, he supported himself by small jobs of manual labor. By 1910, he was living in a home for poor working men. He didn't have mommy to support him. I have an issue with that, but we won't go into that. In 1913, Hitler received a small amount of money from his father's estate, and he moved to Munich. In Salzburg, he had been rejected for military service, but in Munich, he volunteered to serve in the Bavarian army as an Austrian citizen. By all accounts, he served barely in the Bavarian Reserve Infantry Regiment. Bravely, not barely. Bravely. as a dispatch runner on the Western Front in France and Belgium. He received the Iron Cross, second class, in 1914, the Iron Cross, first class, in 1918, and the Black Wound Badge in 1918. He was wounded in the left thigh during the Battle of the Somme in October 1916 and temporarily blinded by mustard gas in October 1918. I'm wondering, is that what made him so nasty? His childhood and then the service stuff. Believing his prospects to be slim in civilian life, Hitler had hoped to stay in the army as long as possible. But he was released from service after the defeat of the Austro-Hungarian army on November 11, 1918. Although he had continued sketching and cartooning while he served in the trenches, his chances of surviving as an artist seemed no more practical or possible than they had before he joined the army. I did not know Hitler was doing this artistic stuff. In July 1919, Hitler managed to be appointed... Excuse me, I got to mute. Goodness sake, I just woke up from my nap and I can't seem to get the rest of my body to wake up. Hold on. Goodness sake. Where were we? In July 1919, Hitler managed to be appointed as an intelligence agent of the... R-E-I-C-H-W-E-H-R, the Provisional National Defense Unit that had been established by the newly formed Weimar Republic. It was Hitler's job to maintain morale among the soldiers. I can't imagine him doing that. Okay, wait a minute. I got to react to this. It was Hitler's job to maintain morale among the soldiers and at the same time to spy upon the German Workers' Party, DAP. I can see him pull his gun out and say, "You get happy now or I'll kill you." I just can't picture him being in charge of morale. Okay. On September 12, 1919, during one of DAP's meetings at the... There's no way in the world I'll pronounce this. STERNECKERBRAU. A beer hall in the center of the city. Hitler challenged one of the speakers and began such a violent argument that Anton Drexler, a founder of the DAP, invited him to join the party. Must have been a bunch of angry people, huh? The German Workers' Party. Drexler was a member of the occult Thule, T-H-U-L-E, Society, and the first members of the DAP were largely made up of fellow members of that secret society. Oh. Oh. Okay. Making sense now. Okay, I need another drink. Hold on. Okay. As a An associate of Drexler's, Dr. Paul Taffel, also a member of the Thule Society, was a leader of two workers' unions who wished to form a society that would organize the masses with a strong nationalistic fervor. Karl Harrer, or Harrer, H-A-R-R-E-R, a sports journalist and a member of the Thule Society, envisioned a union of German workers under the influence of the society. Another founder of DAP, Dietrich Eckart, was also a member of the Thule Society, and he became one of Hitler's mentors in the doctrine of the mystical organization. Soon, Hitler was learning about the ancient tradition of the Master of the World, who with his occult powers and his army of super race would launch an invasion of Earth and subjugate all humans to his will. I never realized all this because I didn't get into Hitler. Just thinking about Hitler hurt me because he hurt so many people, so I never delved into him in his history. So now that I'm learning this stuff and he's in this occult and all that, I can understand a lot better why he didn't have any problem executing all those people. Heck, he might have counted them as offerings to his Satan, I don't know. New section called The Thule Society and the Coming Race. Of great influence on the Thule Society was The Coming Race, 1871, a novel by the occultist Edward Bulwer Lytton that was set in the Earth's interior, where an advanced civilization of giants thrived. In this story, the giants had built a paradise and discovered a form of energy so powerful that they outlawed its use. I gotta sneeze. Well, okay, because I had to sneeze and told you it wouldn't come out. Jeez. So where were we with this? In this story, the giant had built a paradise and discovered a form of energy so powerful that they outlawed its use as a potential weapon. This force, the Vril, V like Victor, R-I-L, was derived from the Black Sun, a large ball of prima materia that provides light and radiation to the inhabitants of the inner earth. The Vril was known among the alchemists and magicians as the Chi, C-H-I, the Odic Force, the Orgon, or the Astral Light, and they were well aware of its transformative powers to create supermen of ordinary mortals. The secret society of the Black Sun coexisted with the Vril and the Thule societies in Germany prior to and during World War I, and was blended with the other groups in about 1919. While these societies borrowed some concepts and rites from Theosophists, T-H-E-O-S-O-P-H-I-S-T-S, Rosicrucians and various hermetic groups, they placed special emphasis on the innate mystical powers of the Aryan race, A-R-Y-A-N. Others such as, I don't know what MME stands for. I don't know if that's Mademoiselle or Madam or what, but it's MME dot Helena Blavatsky had listed the six root races, the astral, Hyperborean, Lemurian, Atlantean, Aryan, and the coming master race. The Germanic? No, I got to sneeze again. Success! Sneeze came out. Now maybe I can get back to normal. Whatever that is. The Germanic, Nordic, Teutonic people were of Aryan origin, and Christianity had destroyed the power of the Teutonic civilization. The symbol of the black sun is suggestive of the plight of the sun when, according to Norse myths, the great wolf Fenrir, F-E-N-R-I-R, will swallow the solar orb at the beginning of the wolf age. As in many secret groups, there appears to have been more than one order. Those who followed the golden sun and those who followed the black sun. The black sun, like the swastika, is a very ancient symbol. While the swastika represents the eternal foundation of creation, the black sun is even older, suggesting the very void of creation itself. It's the end of that section. Now, the Thule sun wheel becomes the swastika. While Hitler was being informed about the master race within the earth, his fellow party members of DAP were being quickly won over to his political beliefs and the passion with which he preached them, seeking to make the party more broadly appealing to larger segments of the population. The DAP was renamed on February 24, 1920, to the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the Nazi Party. Hitler designed the party's symbol, the Thule Sonnenrad, sun wheel, a swastika in a white circle on a red background. I apologize, I'm having a difficult time right now. Jeez. Okay. The end of World War I had left Germany with its people poor and its morale low. The Vril would be the means of the nation's restoration as a major world power. Those who learned control of the Vril would become masters of themselves, those around them, and the world itself. Such members of the Lodge as Adolf Hitler, Heinrich Himmler, Hermann Göring, Dr. Theodor Moral, Hitler's personal physician, and other top Nazi leaders became obsessed with preparing German youth to become a master race. They wanted desperately to prove themselves worthy of the superhumans that lived beneath the surface of the planet. Done with that section. Nancy, can we take a break right now?
Yes, yes, we can. 4 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
We'll be right back.
And you are back.
I needed that break pretty bad. I think I'm better. I certainly hope so. That was a rough time. Okay. Now we're ready to start with joining subterranean supermen to create a human mutation. An important element in the developing Nazi mythos, M-Y-T-H-O-S, was the belief that representatives of a powerful underground secret race emerged from time to time to walk among Homo sapiens. Hitler's frenzied desire to breed a select race of Nordic types was inspired by his obsessive hope that it should be the Germanic peoples who would be chosen above all other humans to interbreed with the subterranean supermen. In the mutation of a new race of heroes, demigods, and godmen. Although some authorities on the life of Hitler and the rise of the Nazi Party state that the Führer did not maintain his interest in the occult, but soon turned his attention to the promotion of pan-Germanism, anti-Semitism, anti-communism, and the worldwide establishment of the Third Reich. Some who worked closely with him say otherwise. Those are a number of reports. There are a number of reports by witnesses who claim to have heard Hitler screaming in terror and, having rushed to his aid, found him cowering in a corner of his office, weeping and shivering in terror that a representative of the master race from the inner earth had just paid him an unwelcomed visit. That would be kind of scary. When he's, I don't know if he really believed it existed. Surprise! In there, the morning of the magicians, secret societies, conspiracies, and vanished civilizations, Avalon 1960, Lewis Powell's and Jakes Bergier, quote, Herman Rauschning, Rauschning, governor of Danzig during the Third Reich, who repeated a conversation he had once had with Hitler concerning the Führer's plan to assist nature in developing mutants. The new man is living amongst us now. He is here. Isn't that enough for you? I will tell you a secret. I have seen the new man. He is intrepid and cruel. I was afraid of him. That's what Hitler said. Rauschning went on to state that he was told by a person very close to Hitler that the Führer often awoke in the night screaming and in convulsions. Always the frightened dictator would shout that he had come for him, that he stood there in the corner of the room, that he had emerged from his underworld kingdom to invade the Führer's bedroom. Wow. It must have really terrified him. New section. Was Hitler a spirit medium? If, as Herman, the R name, recalled, Hitler appeared to relate his encounters with the representative of the emergent mutant species in a kind of ecstasy or trance-like state, we can wonder if there is credence to the many rumors and theories that the Führer was mediumistic. In addition to his membership in several occult societies, Hitler's birthplace, the little village of Branau-Amin, was for many years a center of spiritualism in Europe. And it has often been said that the infant Adolf shared the same wet nurse with Willy Schneider, who, along with his brother Rudy, became a world-famous medium. Whether or not Hitler could be called a true medium, it was while the Vril Society, now named, oh good God, how am I going to say that? I'm just going to spell it. First word is Vril, and then it's GESELLSCHAFT. Grellschaft, maybe? Was meeting at an old hunting lodge near Berchtesgaden that they received remarkable news that Maria Orsich. They have Maria Orsich, and then in parentheses, Orsich had begun to receive messages from Aryan aliens on Alpha Torah and the Aldebaran star system. Maria led the Vrillerinnen, a group of beautiful young mediums in the society, and she and her sister medium named Sigrun had learned that a half billion years ago the Aryans, also known as Elohim or Elder Race, began to colonize our solar system. On Earth, the Aryans were identified as the Sumerians until they elected to carve out an empire for themselves in the hollow of the planet. The Vrillinen, oh, this is a new section. The Vrillinen channel transmissions for advanced spaceflight. Wow. I didn't realize the Germans had so much to do with this kind of stuff. Maria, Sigrun, and other members of the Vrillinen Trot, T-R-A-U-T-E, Gudrun, and Heike, H-E-I-K-E, began to channel themselves that channel transmissions that dictated diagrams and blueprints of advanced flying machines, complete with the mathematics and physics to go with them. The mediums wore their hair long to serve as better receptive antennas for the alien messages. I've been letting my hair grow so it's down to my top of my waist now, and I never thought of it as being antennas. Just kind of cracks me up. By 1921, some say that a working model of what would one day be called a flying saucer had been built, working in underground bases with the alien intelligences. The Nazis mastered anti-gravity spaceflight, established space stations, accomplished time travel, and developed their spacecraft to warp speeds. In 1922, members of Thule and Vril claimed to have built the, oh, come on, JENSEITSFLUG machine. I can't even begin to pronounce it. The Other World Flight Machine, based on the psychic messages received from the Aldebaran aliens. W.O. Schumann of the Technical University of Munich was in charge of the project until it was halted in 1924, and the craft was stored in Messerschmitt's Augsburg facility. In 1937, after Hitler came into power, he authorized the construction of the ruined Flugzeug. And this just made me want to throw the book in the air and give up. But I shall continue. I will spell what I'm attempting to say. R-U-N-D is first word. Second word, F-L-U-G-Z-E-U-G. Okay, that's what he authorized the construction of. The round or disc-shaped vehicle for military use and for space flight. A few years later, the Fuhrer officially abolished all secret societies, but sources indicate that the Vril continued its work unabated. I don't think he managed to abolish all of them. They're still around. In 2012, Iron Sky, a Finnish science fiction film about the Nazis' development of flying discs, reignited a debate in Germany about Hitler's development of UFOs. The film centers on real-life SS officer Hans Kammler, who was said to have made a significant breakthrough in anti-gravity experiments toward the end of World War II. The film relates how, from a secret base built in the Antarctic, the first Nazi spaceships were launched in late 1945 to build a military base named S-C-H-W-A-R-Z-E is the first word. S-O-N-N-E is the second word. And in parentheses it says Black Sun on the moon. To build a military base named Black Sun on the moon. I've been saying there's a base up there or two. This base was to be used to build a powerful invasion fleet and return to Earth in 2018. Well, I didn't notice their return. I don't know if any of you out there did. If they did so, they did it very quietly. Very interesting. According to reports published in German in the magazine PM, there is strong evidence that the Nazi UFO program was well advanced, based on an alien saucer that crashed in Italy. The PM report quotes eyewitnesses who state that they saw a flying saucer marked with an Iron Cross insignia flying low over the Thames in 1944. Other eyewitnesses claim that they saw a flying saucer type craft produced in Prague in 1945 actually become airborne. Records state that the best known of the Nazi UFO projects was the Shriver-Habermas scheme, named for Rudolf Shriver and Otto Habermas. According to PM Magazine, Joseph Andreas Epp, an engineer, said 15 disc prototypes were built in all. with a central cockpit surrounded by rotating adjustable wing vanes forming a circle. The pitch of the vanes could be adjusted so that during takeoff, more lift was generated by increasing their angle from a more horizontal setting. Period. In level flight, the angle would be adjusted to a smaller angle, similar to the way helicopter rotors operate. The wing vanes were to be set in rotation by small rockets placed around the rim like a pinwheel. Once rotational speed was sufficient, liftoff was achieved. Wow. A new section called the Nazi Expedition to the Hollow Earth. I never in the world dreamed I'd be reading this kind of stuff. Really interesting. The Nazi Expedition to the Hollow Earth. Subscribing to another popular pseudoscientific theory, Hitler had come to believe that Earth was concave and that humankind lived on the inside of the globe. According to the theory, advanced by a number of the Führer's like-minded scientists, if the Nazis were to station their most accomplished radar experts in the correct geometric position, they would be able to determine the precise position of the British fleet and the Allied bomber squadrons, because the concave curvature of the globe would enable infrared rays to accomplish long-distance monitoring. In April 1942, Hitler, and in brackets it says Nazi Party leaders, Hermann Göring and Heinrich Himmler, and their fellow exponents of the Hollow Earth belief construct, sent an expedition to the island of Rügen in the Baltic Sea to establish the radar base. Based on the teachings of the Vril Society, they had complete confidence in their application of the ancient vision of the concave planet. At the same time, there were certain very old traditions that insisted that the Knights Templar had hidden the Holy Grail and the Ark of the Covenant somewhere on one of the Baltic islands. Nancy, are the Baltic Islands near Oak Island? Give her a second.
No.
Oh, okay.
Oak Island's on the Nova Scotia, and the Balkan Islands are near the Balkans, aren't they?
I don't know. I don't know geography.
I think it's in Eastern Europe area.
Oh, man, I thought we could tie that together.
No, not yet.
Okay, thanks. Far from being a fanciful plot device created for the Indiana Jones motion picture series, Hitler did authorize a number of expeditions formed by Himmler to acquire as many holy relics as possible. The Führer and his inner circle believed that such a grand accomplishment as possessing such legendary artifacts of power and majesty, as well as discovering an entrance to the inner empire, would convince the ancient masters who lived there that the Nazis were truly worthy of mixing their blood with them in the hybridization of a master race. Boy, he was really obsessed with them, wasn't he? Okay, I'm ready to start a new section, and it's pretty much the top of the hour, so can we take another break? I know.
Yes, yes.
Yes, her name.
Okay, it's only $4.49. I mean...
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, Lord, I was reading wrong.
Well,
okay.
Let me put my glasses on. It's $4.50. It's $4.50, but I'll give you a break if you want
it. That's okay. Let me go ahead and read this next section.
Okay.
I'm just holding out today. Okay. Let's do another section, and then we'll take a break. Oops, I muted myself. I'm really confused. Oh, come on, Dolly, get with it. Ooh, here's a picture that looks like Jesus in the negative type picture. The old ones have had their otherworldly hands in human events for centuries, influencing rulers from King Charles the 12th of Sweden to Napoleon Bonaparte. The art's by Ricardo Pustanio. And it looks like a negative of the face of what we consider what everyone portrays Jesus to look like. Won't everybody be surprised when he looks completely different? Okay. New section. World leaders who received visits from the old ones. Adolf Hitler was not the only world leader who was said to have received visitations from mysterious counselors from the old ones in the Hollow Earth. The Red Man first appeared to Napoleon. The Red Man? Yeah. The Red Man first appeared to Napoleon during the ambitious military leader's Egyptian campaign. The strange little visitor claimed to have warned the rulers of France in the past and declared that he had now come to warn Napoleon. When Napoleon protested the Red Man's admonition that the people of France were growing to fear his ambition, the mysterious advisor told the military genius that he had been at his side since he was but a schoolboy. "I know you better than you know yourself," he chided him. The Red Man told Napoleon that his orders to the French fleet had not been obeyed, even though the Egyptian campaign had begun on a note of triumph. After the bloody battle of the pyramids, the enterprise would fail, and Napoleon would return to France to find her closed in by England, Russia, Turkey, and an allied Europe. Domestically, the Red Man warned, Napoleon would be confronted by the mobs of Paris. True to the Red Man's prediction, the Egyptian campaign failed. In 1809, after the Battle of Wagram, Napoleon made his headquarters at Schönbrunn, where one lonely midnight, he again received his mysterious advisor. The Red Man made his third and final appearance on the morning of January 1, 1814, shortly before the emperor was forced to abdicate. The stranger appeared first to counselor and future prime minister, Louis Matthew Mole, with an accent over the E, and demanded that he be allowed to see the emperor on matters of urgent importance. Mole had been given strict orders that the emperor was not to be disturbed, but when he went with the message that the Red Man was there, the mysterious stranger was granted immediate entrance. It is said that Napoleon beseeched the Red Man for time to complete the execution of certain proposals, but the prophetic messenger gave him only 3 months to achieve a general peace, or it would be all over for him. In a futile effort to gain more time, Napoleon desperately tried to launch a new Eastern campaign. Such a move left Paris to fall into the hands of the Allies, and on April 1, 3 months after the Red Man's final appearance, Talleyrand and the Senate called for Napoleon's abdication. King Charles XII of Sweden sought the counsel of a little gray man with ruddy complexion, who gave him a ring that would not vanish until the day of the ruler's death. Oh, these little men, I never heard about these little men before. King Charles cut a mighty swath across Europe, Russia, and Turkey, and his feats became legendary. As did Napoleon, Charles resisted his mysterious counselors' entreaties to make peace. In 1718, as the Swedes were besieging Frederikshald, one of Charles's officers noticed that the ring was no longer on his leader's finger. Moments later, Charles fell dead with a head wound. Well, that'll be a lesson he'll never be able to learn from. New section called, yeah, I can do it, Racial Memories of an Underground Advanced Civilization. In the March 1945 issue of Amazing Stories, editor Ray Palmer introduced the Shaver Mysteries, a purported racial memory of a young welder named Richard Shaver, 1907 to 1975, who first claimed to have remembered a life in the caves, then later maintained that he had recently been in the vast underground civilization of cave dwellers. Life magazine, May 21, 1951, called the Shaver Mystery the most celebrated rumpus that ever wrecked the science fiction world. Richard Shaver, however, never called his accounts anything other than factual reportage. It was Richard Shaver's contention that in prehistoric times, when our solar system was young, Earth was inhabited by a race of cosmic super beings who had come here from another solar system. Although the elder race were not truly immortals, they had discovered secrets of incredible longevity. This, together with their highly developed scientific technology, caused them to be regarded as gods by the primitive and unsophisticated humans. The elder race possessed fantastic mechanical devices, which Shaver calls mech, M-E-C-H, I guess is how you'd say mech, capable of projecting three-dimensional images, extracting or implanting thoughts into others' minds, scanning over great distances, curing diseases, producing food and clothing, and killing and destroying life when necessary. In Shaver's version of the Hollow Earth Masters, after a time, the Titans began to notice that the once beneficent sun now contained detrimental rays that were shortening their lifespan by causing premature aging. To escape the harmful rays of the sun, the elder race entered deep underground caverns and began carving a fantastic subterranean kingdom, using their ray guns to disintegrate rock. Soon they had constructed powerful machines that could duplicate the health-giving rays of the sun while excluding the detrimental radioactivity. Homo sapiens continued to evolve in the sun, ignorant of the rays, which shortened their lifespan and puzzled by the withdrawal of their gods. Shaver warned his readers that the elder race was not without its sensualist. What? Was not without its sensualist. S-E-N-S-U-A-L-I-S-T-S. And certain of its members, particularly the lesser ones, varied greatly in morality and intelligence. Perhaps the majority of the elder race regarded their lesser evolved human cousins with the superiority and ill-concealed contempt that a pompous research scientist might feel walking amongst Stone Age Aborigines. Others may have exploited the females of the human tribes and may even have set the more barbaric tribes against each other for the perverse pleasure of the elder race, who may have openly rooted for and secretly assisted their favorite tribes and warriors. The more humane among the elder race did their best to assist the primitive humans to develop a more functional culture and technology. According to Shaver, the ancient myths and legends are the unsophisticated surface dwellers' version of the myriad activities of the elder race. Okay, we're time. My clock says 5:02. Can we do a break now?
Yes.
Okay.
It's your favorite 5 minutes.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
And you are back.
Oh, that really relaxed me. I needed that. Thank you.
Welcome.
New section called A Warning to Future Humankind. Shaver's warning to future humankind was that the Dero, D-E-R-O, see page 119. Well, we'll get there in just a second. Let me start it over. Shaver's warning to the future humankind was that the Dero are becoming more numerous and have scattered the benign Tiro with their constant attacks. The greatest threat to humanity lies in the grim fact that the Dero have access to all the machines of the Atlan technology, but they don't have the intelligence or the highly developed moral sense of the ancients to use these machines responsibly. The Dero have possession of vision ray machines that can penetrate solid rock and pick up scenes all over Earth in order to accomplish instant transport from one point to another. They have access to the Atlan's transportation units. Frighteningly, the Dero long ago gained control of the mental machinery that can induce solid illusions, dreams, and compulsions in topsiders. In addition to the aerial craft that we call UFOs, the Dero possess death rays that can wreak terrible havoc. According to Shaver, the Dero are notorious for their sexual orgies, and they apply STIM, STIM, machines that revitalize sexual virility, and BEN, be like boy, EN, rays that heal and restore the physical body. These mechanisms were created by the ancient Atlans thousands of years ago and are still in perfect working, typo there, And let me read over it. The mechanisms were created by the ancient Atlants thousands of years ago and are still in perfect working order because of the high degree of technical perfection with which they were constructed. Boy, there's a lot of typo in that. I really had to work through it. We surface dwellers, are the descendants of the Abandandero, who were unable to gain access to the caves at the time of the great exodus of the Titans from Earth. Most of our early ancestors died off. Some degenerated into such lumbering hominids as Neanderthal. Others, the hardy ones, survived, and through the centuries, our species has developed a greater tolerance for the sun, which allows us to live even longer than the subsurface tetro with their machines of rejuvenation. At the same time, the beneficial rays of the sun have prevented in our kind the mental and physical deterioration that perverts the Dero and weakens the Tiro. Although we have a common heritage with the Tiro and the Dero, the passage of time has prevented the great mass of surface dwellers from possessing more than dim memories of the glory days of Atlantis, Lemuria, Mu, Mu, and the epochs when there were giants in the earth. However, Shaver cautions us by no means have the Dero forgotten us. These sadistic monsters take enormous delight in creating terrible accidents, confusing the goals of our political leaders, provoking surface wars between nations, and even in causing nightmares by focusing dream mech on us while we sleep. Who are these dudes? These sadistic monsters. Yeah, Dero. Dero, D like dog, E-R-O. Monsters take enormous delight in creating terrible accidents, confusing the goals of our political leaders. That's what I was trying to get to. So do you think it's the Dero's fault that our political leaders are swamp beings? I don't know. I just wish they were gone. In later years, Ray Palmer left the pressures of working for Ziff Davis and its string of magazines and chose to establish a publishing company in his native Wisconsin. When Brad Steiger met with him in the late 1960s, Ray lived on a heavily wooded 124-acre farm near Amherst, Wisconsin, just a few miles from the converted school building that housed the Amherst Press and from where he issued such magazines as Flying Saucers, Space World, Rocket Exchange, Forum, and Search. Perhaps I made a grave mistake, Palmer said, but I altered what Shaver stated were his thought records into racial memory. I felt certain that the concept of racial memory would be far more believable to the readers and offer a reasonable and perhaps actual explanation of what was really going on in Shaver's mind, which is where I felt it really was going on, and not in any caves or via any T-log rays or telesolidograph projections of illusions from the cavern rays operators. On the other hand, dot, 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 that's how he leaves that chapter. Maybe he should have just left it alone and let the guy tell what he saw. Why do people think they got to correct everybody? And then they don't believe people when it's something that they've not encountered before. Oh, well. Let's move along to the next chapter. Oh, this is cool. The Wee People, Guardians of the Earth Mother. Brandy wrote to tell of an incident that has always stood out in her mind, even though it occurred some years ago. She was doing dishes, washing and rinsing and cleaning counters in the downstairs kitchen when the following occurred. Here's what occurred. I was at the end of the kitchen counter moving things around, she said, when something caught my attention. It was like a quick spark of light, and it flashed before disappearing. I looked at the kitchen table, and under it I saw a movement. I looked from where I was to see someone, a small female being, crawling under the table. She sat there, with her knees bent and head hunched, peeking out at me. At first, we stared at each other. Oh, hold on. I have to unplug this. It's fully charged. Okay, so at first we stared at each other. As she blended in with the morning sunlight, it seemed as if she wasn't fully corporeal. She shifted as if agitated, as if she had not expected me to see her. She wasn't wearing any clothes, it seemed, and her hair was messy and ragged, going all over the place. She had wide eyes that looked sort of scared. We continued just to stare at one another until I decided maybe I could extend an olive branch and talk. I tried saying hello in the most non-threatening way I could, but she just freaked out and with a sharp breath, vanished. Later on, I went to look at the book Fairies by Brian Froud, F-R-O-U-D, and there on the cover was a being similar to the female being that I had seen under the kitchen table. The resemblance shocked me, because here was the girl on the cover of a book of beings that I never would have thought to actually exist. Yet there she was. And that's the end of that section. Here's a new one called Meeting Wee Folk Unaware. Many readers of this book will agree with Brandy that they, too, have encountered numerous beings that they never would have thought actually existed. In this chapter, we will hear from those individuals who had their reality altered forever by meeting fairies unawares. A world of advice. No. A word of advice from the annals of encountering the wee folk. If you should ever meet an entity that appears very much like the beings portrayed in your old children's book of fairy tales, and if you wish to survive the meeting without any nastiness, there are two rules you must remember. Don't you dare ask its name. And don't you dare call it a fairy. Better remember that. Sounds serious. Hold on, I have to adjust my position. I'm so out of sorts today. I apologize. According to those who speak the Gaelic tongue of Scotland and Ireland, the wee folk prefer to be known as S-I-D-H-E, also spelled S-I-D-H, S-I-T-H, S-I-T-H-C-H-E, and pronounced she, S-H-E-E. There is disagreement as to the exact meaning of the she. Some say that it refers to the mounds or hills in which the supernatural folk abide. Others say that it means the people of peace, and that is how the she generally behave toward humans, except for two seemingly incurable elfin's traits. One, kidnapping human children to rear as their own, and leaving one of their own, a changeling, to be reared by the unsuspecting human parents. And two, shape-shifting into a seemingly endless variety of forms in order to work mischief, usually for the good, for baffled humans. New section called. A small voice called to Gretchen in a Wisconsin forest. Gretchen from Milwaukee writes that one day, as she was relaxing in a lovely Wisconsin forest, admiring the beauty of nature's handiwork, she heard a small voice calling out to her. As she looked down to the spot from which the voice had echoed, she saw a little elf-like creature sitting on the trunk of a tree. She returned his greeting and asked his name. He said I could call him Pumpkin, Gretchen told us. He appeared at first to be less than 2 feet tall, but then, suddenly, he grew much larger for a moment, then shrank back down. I did that with the expansion and contraction of my breathing, he told Gretchen. I knew you would like to see it. Pumpkin explained that he worked with the vegetable kingdom, the plants and the shrubs. He and his kind energized the etheric bodies of the plant kingdom, so that all life can be maintained and strengthened. After they had spoken for a moment or two, Pumpkin suddenly looked up from his work with the shrubs as though he heard someone call. I must go now, he smiled at Gretchen, then disappeared. Gretchen told us that after her encounter with the wee, loving, happy nature spirit, she was even more deeply in awe of God's kingdoms and his creations on our beautiful earth. The end of that section. Here's a new section. Encountering nature spirits in Sedona. Charmaine Yaroon Borick moved from Los Angeles to Sedona, Arizona, and soon began to feel as though she was walking with one foot in earthbound reality and the other foot in another dimension. She laughingly conceded that she doesn't always know just what side she's on, but said, it is all magical and it is all so beautiful. I feel that way a lot of times. Charmaine was working on a book about nature spirits, and she said that she had seen quite a number of the etheric entities in the Sedona area. According to her analysis of the beings, she has found them to be quite different from the ones that she had met before in other places. I don't always see elementals, she said. I wish I could. Hold on, I gotta rub my eye, hold on. Oh, dear. got one of those itches that just said, you're not going to ignore me, because I was trying to. Okay, where is she? She said, I wish I, I don't always see elementals, she said. I wish I could, nor can I tell others how to see them. It is just when I'm particularly filled with an exquisite joy and love that they just suddenly appear. And they are as solid as you and I. The energies that Charmaine discovered in Sedona were very strong and sometimes quite capricious. On one occasion, she said she had been walking on rocks downhill when she suddenly stumbled. I turned a somersault in the air and landed on my face. Ooh, ow, she said. I could have been badly hurt, but I was not injured in the slightest. At first, I couldn't believe what had happened. A nature spirit had grabbed hold of me and taken care of me so I would not be hurt. The being had turned me over in the air and set me down gently. Huh? That was special. Whether or not it was Charmaine's intense interest in researching the nature spirits that attracted the entities to her energy, she believes that their intercession during what could have been a very nasty fall indicates their essential benign feelings toward humans. New section. Ginger has interacted with we people since childhood. Oh, that's special. Her parents didn't make her forget. We were surprised when a friend of long standing admitted to us that she had interacted with the wee people since her early childhood. I think they come from another dimension, Ginger said. I may be sitting just kind of staring at the floor, and suddenly little specks will seem to appear and to move about and form a picture of one of these beings. And then there he is beside me. Sometimes there will be two, three, or more of these wonderful characters manifesting before me. A smile always crosses my lips because these little beings are my friends. They've been with me for many years since my early childhood. My grandma, right, my mom's mom, was telling me one time about how she sees what was just described here. And she got so excited and so animated while she was telling me about them. She said, they come and they play in front of me and we talk and they sing. And Grandma's blind at that point. She was blind. She had macular degeneration and doctors had operated on her and flubbed up and left her blind. So when she's telling me about the little beings and she sees them, I was just so enthralled by the feelings in the room, by what she was saying, by looking at her, by feeling her vibrations when she was telling me. It was a really fantastic, wonderful sharing that I'm glad I was able to hear from her. I don't feel it is a psychic thing, Ginger explained. I don't go into a trance or somehow will the beings to appear. To me, these beings are more real than the so-called natural world around me. Sometimes these little beings talk to me, but their voices seem to come from inside my head. It's more often like a thought than a sound. Besides relaxing me and entertaining me, these entities help me in many ways. For instance, Ginger continued, several days ago I was sitting quietly, watching these little people as they danced for me. Suddenly one of them said, "Why are you sad today?" Another one spoke up and said, "Instead of worrying about your problems, why don't you help somebody?" As he danced away, he spoke again. "Remember, you can't help someone else without helping yourself too." With that final comment, they all vanished. Later that day, Ginger did have an opportunity to help someone, and while she didn't expect things to turn out the way they did, the eventual results opened a door that brought more help to her than anything else had done for a long time. "I am always grateful to the little people for their good advice," Ginger said. And she's not going to share it with us? That's the end of that section. Another section.
Wait a minute, you want a break? It's at the half hour.
Oh, yes, I would love one.
Here we go.
Just a small town girl living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere. Just a city boy born and raised in South Detroit. He took the midnight train going a singer in a smoky room, a smell of wine and cheap perfume. For a smile they can share the night. It goes on and on.
Living just to find emotion high.
And you're alive.
Okay, thank you. Amongst Iger questionnaire respondents, nearly 30% report seeing wee folk. This is a new section. Did I read this other one? Oh, yeah, I did. Okay. Among the more than 30,000 men and women who have returned the Steiger questionnaire of mystical, paranormal, and UFO experiences, a remarkable 29% claim to have seen elves, fairies, or some form of nature spirit. Betty Kirkland, who now lives in a suburb of Chicago, wrote in her response to the Steiger questionnaire that she had acquired fairy helpers when she was just a child of three. I am now 33, married, and with two little girls, 8 and 6, and I think they too have received fairy guardians, for I have seen little sparkles of light above their heads when they are sleeping. I could turn the fan on. All of a sudden, I'm having a heat flash. That's a word I was looking for in Dolly Shares. Jeez. Oh, well. Done now. Let's see. Not the one for today, but the one I did after that. Where am I? Sleeping. Okay. Betty recalled when she was 3 years old, she first saw the wee people on the farm in central Illinois where she spent her childhood. I saw a little man and little woman picking apples that had fallen from the trees in our orchard. They were taller than I was at that age, so I thought at first they were just some very short people that my mother had allowed to enter our orchard. What really caught my attention is the way they were dressed, with their conical hats and bright green and red costumes. I thought they wore very strange clothing for farmers. When Betty approached them, they just smiled at her and went on picking certain apples and placing them in colorful cloth bags. But when, in my childish curiosity and bluntness, I asked them what their names were, they looked shocked, she recalled. The little man's mouth dropped, and the woman gasped in a shrill, tiny voice. Oh, no. She can see us. She's not supposed to be able to see us. And then Betty said the man began to laugh in a high-pitched giggle. Sure she can see us, he told his companion. She's got the gift. See the glow around her wee head? Betty remembered that the woman asked the man if the child is a changeling, although that term meant nothing to her at the time. Betty later learned that a changeling, according to fairy lore, is a hybrid fairy-human child that the fairies sometimes leave in place of a newborn infant that they borrow to take with them to their underworld kingdom. The male introduced themselves as fairies, himself as Acorn, his companion as Fluff. Cute names. She made a little curtsy when Acorn introduced her, Betty said. I thought it was so cute when she did. I had never seen a woman do that before. Later that night, when my mother asked me to wash my hands and face for supper, I curtsied. Mom laughed and wondered where I had learned to do that. I told her that a fairy named Miss Fluff had shown me how, and Mom just laughed harder. Betty enjoyed the company of Fluff and Acorn throughout her childhood. They would usually just appear seemingly out of nowhere, she said, so it didn't take me long to figure out that they were invisible to human eyes most of the time. Some evenings I would look out the window of my bedroom and see the fairy lights of Acorn, Miss Fluff, and other fairies mixed in with the fireflies and dancing and swirling around in the darkness. On one dramatic occasion, her two fairy guardians distracted an angry bull from budding 8-year-old Betty when she inadvertently crossed the pasture during a bovine mating event. Ooh, oops, oops. Another time when she was 10, Acorn and Fluff chased off a stray dog that had invaded their farm and was likely rabid. It approached Betty, growling, foaming at the mouth, about to charge, when sparkling lights swirled around its head and pulled it away by its floppy ears. Less than a year later, they saved me from drowning in the creek that ran near our farm, Betty said. I had seen some older neighbor kids jumping off the banks into the water, and I had incorrectly assumed the depth as being much less than it truly was. And to make matters worse, I was alone that afternoon. Oh, boy. As she was soon sputtering, threshing about in the water, panicked that she could not touch the muddy bottom with her toes. I would surely have drowned if Acorn and Fluff had not hovered near me and pulled me to the bank. There was no one else to help me, but my fairy guardians were there. As she grew into her teenage years, Betty saw her fairy friends less and less. But when I was ill or sad or depressed, I would first see sparkling lights swirling around me, and then I would hear their delightful laughter and know that everything would be all right, she said. And so it has been throughout my adult years as well. That's really special. Wow, I don't have any wee folk. But I have a lot of other spirits, so I got nothing to complain about. Or wish for. New section called, Who Are the Wee Folk? Well, I just need to breathe a few seconds here. Okay. For many people today, the image of an elf is firmly established in the characters of either the handsome Legolas Greenleaf or the lovely ethereal Arwen as depicted in the Sir Peter Jackson films of J.R.R. period. Tolkien's Rings saga, as portrayed by actors Orlando Bloom and Liv Tyler, period. While the elves in Tolkien's vision are tall and stately beings, tradition has more often portrayed elves and their fellow citizens from the unseen realm as diminutive, hence the wee people. Small in stature, though they may be, elves, the hidden folk, are not beings with whom to trifle. Oh my gosh, hold on. In most traditions, especially in the British Isles and Scandinavia, the wee people, the fairy folk, were thought to be supernormal beings who inhabited magical kingdoms beneath the surface of the earth. Fairies have always been considered to be very much akin to humans, but they have also been known to be something more than mere mortals and to possess powers that humankind would consider to be magical. And the military would try to turn into a weapon. I don't know why I thought that. I just did. Some theorists have suggested that the fairy folk may actually have been surviving remnants of a past civilization populated by a species of early humans who were of diminutive stature compared to modern Homo sapiens. These little people may have been quite advanced and possessed a technology that seemed to be magical compared to the primitive tools of the migrating primitive hunter-gatherer humans who later became the established residents of the area. The little people may have died out. They may have been assimilated into the encroaching culture by interbreeding. All right, I'm trying to picture that. Moving right along. Or they may largely have gone underground, emerging topside just often enough to be perpetuated in folklore and legend. Other scholars and researchers of the considerable body of fairy lore that exists worldwide maintain that fairies are entities that belong solely to the realm of spirit. Many of the ancient texts declare that the fairies are paraphysical beings, somehow of a middle nature betwixt man and angel. Some biblically inspired authorities have sought to cast fairies as an earthly incarnation assumed by the rebellious angels who were driven out of heaven during the celestial uprising led by Lucifer. These fallen angels, cast from their heavenly abode, took up new residences in the forests, mountains, and lakes of earth. As fallen angels, they now existed in a much diminished capacity, but still possessed more than enough power to be deemed supernatural by the human inhabitants of the planet. In a variation on that account of the fairies' origin, other scholars contend that after the war in heaven, the dispossessed angels materialized on earth and assumed physical bodies very much like those of humans. Those beings declared a little lower than angels. Eventually, these paraphysical beings took humans as mates, thereby breeding a hybrid species of entities betwixt man and angel. Medieval theologians seem to favor the three possible theories to explain the origin of fairies. One, they are a special class of demoted angels. Two, they are the dead or a special class of the dead. Three, they are fallen angels. Most of the ancient texts declare that the fairies are of a middle nature betwixt man and angel. And because they are of a nature between spirits and humans, they can intermarry and bear children. This belief echoes the passages in Genesis, which tell that the sons of God, the fallen angels, intermarried with the fair daughters of men and produced people of great abilities on earth. In most traditions, the fairies are a race of beings, the counterparts of humankind in person, but at the same time, non-physical or multidimensional. Unlike angels or other multidimensional beings, fairies are thought to be mortal in existence, even though they lead much longer lives than their human cousins. Shakespeare made fairies famous in a number of his masterworks, such as A Midsummer Night's Dream. He is largely responsible for the concept of the wee folk as being mostly benign, mischievous perhaps, but never evil. Sir Walter Scott emphasized the beauty of the fairy realm and the struggle of the fairies to achieve human-like souls. The famed poet W.B. Yeats had a nearly obsessive interest in the paranormal and believed strongly in fairies. C.S. Lewis, author of many classic books on spiritual matters, including Mere Christianity and The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, The Witch, and The Wardrobe, once wrote that the wee folk are a third rational species. The angels are the highest, having perfect goodness and whatever knowledge is necessary for them to do God's will. Humans, somewhat less perfect, are the second fairies, having certain powers of the angels, but no souls are the third. Since the beginning of time, it seems that the human race and the ultra-dimensional race of fairies have shared this planet, experiencing a strange symbiotic relationship, period. In all traditions, the fairy folk are depicted as possessing many more powers and abilities than Homo sapiens. But for some inexplicable reason, they are strongly dependent on human beings. And from time to time, they seek to reinforce their own kind by kidnapping both children and adults. Tales of folk being abducted by smallish beings did not begin in the last few decades with the stories of UFO abductions by small bug-eyed aliens. Did not. Through the centuries, many people have noted the clear parallels between the actions and deeds of the fairies and the angels. Throughout the long history of interaction between humans and fairies, there have been those mortal men and women who have somehow managed to win the favor of the fairies through a process beyond the ken of mortal men. If the fairies see fit to do so, they will even assist at the birth of a special mortal couple's child, and they will tutor and protect that child throughout his or her lifetime, just as guardian angels would. On behalf of such favored humans, the wee ones can materialize to help a poor farmer harvest a crop and have it in the bins before a storm hits. Or they can clean a kitchen in the twinkling of an eye to erase the stress of an exhausted housemaid. Jeez, I've never had any of those come to my kitchen. And I would be so exhausted, I'd have to hold myself up by leaning on the sink while I was doing the dishes. It's hard when you have three kids and you work full time and your husband doesn't lift a finger to help you. It's hard. You get worn out. Especially when you got a boy who thinks the days are nights. Nights are days. He's got him confused. That boy was that way from conception throughout to this day. Oh, let's see, where am I? I got sidetracked again. Let me start here because I got myself lost. I really did. Through the centuries, many people have noted the clear parallels between the actions and deeds of the fairies and the angels. Throughout the long history of interaction between humans and fairies, there have been those mortal men and women who have somehow managed to win the favor of the fairies through a process beyond the ken of mortal men. If the fairies see fit to do so, they will even assist at the birth of a special mortal couple's child. That's where I was. And they will tutor and protect that child throughout his or her lifetime, just as guardian angels would. On behalf of such favored humans, the wee ones can materialize to help a poor farmer harvest a crop and have it in the bins before a storm hits. Or they can clean a kitchen in the twinkling of an eye to ease the stress of an exhausted housemaid. With the advent of the UFO age, there now appeared to be clear parallels between the actions of the fairies and the claims of the actions of extraterrestrial visitors. The fairies are said to be able to enchant humans and take advantage of them. It is often related that they can marry humans, or if they wish no lasting relationship, they can cast a spell on an unlucky lad or lass and have their way with them against the mortal's will. The wee folk seem too often intent on kidnapping human children and rearing them as their own. They also seem to delight in abducting adults and whisking them off to the underground kingdom to trifle with them. Little buggers. As if we don't get enough trifling with. Smallish beings from UFOs also have been reported to hypnotize contactees and abductees in order to employ some kind of mind control in order to make earthlings more malleable. There have been reported cases in which humans claim that they were whisked inside spaceships and experienced missing time upon return. It has been suggested that hundreds of thousands of men and women have been abducted and probed sexually in what has been argued as is an attempt to create a hybrid species. On the positive side, certain contactees have claimed beneficial interactions with aliens that have permitted them to make major scientific discoveries, accomplish medical breakthroughs, and to achieve great material success. Many individuals claim to have been healed after their contact with extraterrestrials, and they have expressed their belief that the aliens are generally benevolent in their intentions towards humans. That's the end of that section. Just in time, I think.
Just in time.
Oh, good. I made it.
Congratulations, another one.
Yeah. So you want to tell them anything? Is anything new that you want to share with them?
No, we just got Jamie coming up. Well, not just, but we got Jamie and you coming up with one-hour shows. Both of them seem really interesting. I didn't get to listen totally to either one of them, but she's going to talk about changes and what do you do about them when you feel like you need to change. What do you do about it?
You change.
Yeah.
You figure it out and you change the way you want to change.
Yes,
in my world.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I'm done. I'm going to have to sleep now.
Okay. Love you.
Love you too. Bye-bye.